Chapter 2, A Flash of White Light. In 2008, I felt for the first time how it was to lose someone close to me. Frank was around my age and one of my best friends from the gym. He had been training with us for several years and was quite a character. Whenever we went out, held gym parties or social events, he was always the center of attention. His extreme intelligence and unique sense of humor was hard not to be fascinated by. For years, Frank and I took the same bus home from training. It was about half an hour, three times a week, where we spent the time discussing training and the meaning of life before we both jumped off at the same stop. He lived right around the corner from me. However, I never went to see his apartment. He studied philosophy and had a burning interest in deadlift, heavy metal music, and jiu-jitsu. His observations on people and the world around him captivated me, and I sucked in as much of his ideas as I could. He even created a political party based on nihilism as a provocation towards the established system's view on life. The party still exists today and had collected enough signatures to be included in the Danish national election in 2011. However, Frank also had a darker side to him, depression. In a way, he was two persons. One who was the most athletic and outgoing social person you could imagine, and one who would lock himself inside his own apartment for 6 months or more and disappear into a world of online poker. He could be away from the gym for long periods at a time, but was that type of guy who always came back one day. He would be standing there in the doorway, laughing, a backpack slung over his shoulder, making some joke about how little I had progressed in deadlift while he had been gone. I was just one hand away from winning a luxury cruise in a poker tournament last night. Then I realized that it was probably time to turn off the computer and get back to training, he said with a grin as he put his gi back on. One day, he stopped coming back. He had just gotten his blue belt after almost 3 years of on and off training. Of all the guys promoted, he got the undoubtedly biggest applause. Everyone knew how big an accomplishment it was for him. After that, I didn't see him for half a year or so and was expecting him to drop by the gym any day for a roll. Then I got the message. It was in the middle of a beautiful warm summer. One Sunday at 5 in the morning, he had somehow broken into a dormitory in the city center and kicked the door into one of the rooms on the fourth floor. The girl who slept there described him as being in complete panic, crying and screaming about war. She had managed to calm him down and tried to find out who he was so she could call someone. He had been sitting on her bed, crying, as she turned around for a moment to find her phone. Then he jumped out the window. Two police officers were on the spot just minutes later, and he died in the arms of one of them. To this day, still no one knows why it happened. He was out with a few friends, but left them at 2 a.m. without looking particularly drunk. He liked to drink, especially Fernet Branca, that he always made us take shots of, only to enjoy the disgusted look on our faces, but he would never touch drugs. What he had done in those 2-3 hours between leaving his friends and breaking into the dormitory, no one will ever know. The autopsy showed nothing. It hit me like a bullet train. I was devastated. I put a note on the door of the gym saying that all classes were cancelled, jumped on my bike and drove towards home, tears running down my cheeks. Waiting at a red light by the edge of the city center, my arms felt like jelly. The light turned green, but I couldn't move. I had to drag my bike to a nearby bench. I sat there for an hour, at least, and stared at nothing, focusing on an empty space of air in front of me. The world just passed by. I wanted to call my girlfriend and tell her what had happened, but I couldn't say anything. I felt so empty inside, like someone had torn out everything and only left me as a shell of a human being. A woman was running past me on the trail going around the lake where I was sitting. She asked if I was okay. I nodded slightly and dried my eyes. No words could come out of my mouth. The usual 30-minute bike ride home took me hours to complete that day. I drove by the place where he jumped. It was just 20 meters from the main tourist street in the city center. People from around the world were still walking there like nothing had ever happened. I observed the spot from far away. I couldn't get myself to go any closer. I could count the number of times I had cried as an adult on one hand, but when I heard the news about Frank, I couldn't stop for days. It just poured out of me. Up until that point, I had felt invincible. It had never even crossed my mind that I or any of my friends were going to die one day, that life had an end. Suddenly, I became very aware of just that. Frank only lived for 31 years. He often joked about how he was stuck in his little apartment in the suburbs and never won enough money in poker to break away from the life he seemed destined to live. I felt horrible for him. The depression had been so obvious, and I blamed myself for not talking to him about it. I had thought about it many times when I felt he was having a down period. Could I have saved him? Should I have acted? When his family cleaned out his apartment, they found a note he had written more than 10 years earlier. Its accuracy in describing the event was scary and made chills run down my spine when I read it. The demons of his depression had been permeating in his mind for a long time. It is an accident that I lie here. It happened so violently, so stupidly. If only I had known it was today, could be today. I admire the terminally ill who wait and wait and wait. Wish I had time like them. Have had time, time to live life, prepare for death. Learn to love in the summer and in the night. Meaning, as I had created, disappeared when I was forced to pick up death. A flash of white light and my trained body was annihilated. It was never essential, so I can still enjoy life as I see it. I laugh at my worst nightmare, my destruction. I do not care. Like most people, I too have always had a dream of doing something great with my life. That dream, however, had never been concrete as to what it was I wanted to do or accomplish. But nevertheless, it had been there since childhood. I had to figure out a master plan to get the most out of my time. If it wasn't for the kick in the ass I got when Frank died, reminding me that everybody has an expiration date and it could be any day around the corner, I might have left it at that. As some blurry fantasy in the back of my head that would get less and less realistic as my life got more and more settled along the fixed railroad tracks it was about to follow. I was determined to do something. Frank never had the chance, so the least I could do for him would be to get something out of my own life before it was too late. Things had to happen. A year and a half later, I was still trying to figure out the master plan that would be my life. My girlfriend had dragged her rootless soul on an 8-month-long trip backpacking around Asia, Australia, and the islands of Polynesia. She was doing voluntary work in a school in Fiji, and I was going to visit her there for 3 weeks. I was impressed by her courage to travel for so long on her own. The longest I'd ever been on the road was 5 weeks, and that had seemed like it was enough for me. Since I met her, she always talked about going on long travels, and now she had finally made it happen. It inspired me, and as we walked around the city of Sydney, kicking brown leaves on the sidewalk of an old stone bridge, dirty cameras hanging over our shoulders, I started to realize what I had been searching for in my mind. I could do something similar. I had traveled a lot for jiu-jitsu training, but always shorter trips. Seeing how my girlfriend effortlessly moved around a vast area between countries, across oceans and cultures, made my own idea come to life. My obligations at home were already minimal, so the time was right. I should go on a jiu-jitsu trip. A really long one. Lying in the bunk bed of a hostel in Sydney that night, I couldn't sleep. My thoughts were racing around my head. I was on a 3-week-long trip around Australia and Fiji, and all I could think about was another travel project. The mother of all travels in my life. We were sat in the common room and had breakfast with 100 other backpackers when I told her about it. She thought it was the best idea ever. Back home in Denmark, the first thing I did was start writing down ideas for my trip. I had already traveled extensively for training in the United States and a bit in Asia. My list of dream jiu-jitsu destinations was still long, as I wanted to visit places like Japan, Hawaii, and a few islands around the Caribbean. And of course, Brazil. What would a life of jiu-jitsu be without a visit to Brazil? As I looked at pins I had set on Google Earth on my computer, trying to decide where to go, the right thing to do became very obvious to me. I could go all the way around the globe. My gym had been running for 7 years at that point, and it was doing fairly well. I wasn't making a lot of money, but enough to put a little aside. More importantly, I had the freedom and flexibility to leave, with lots of skilled guys being able to take over my classes for me while I was gone. I had put myself in a unique situation, and it had taken me a lot of work to get there. So many other people were trapped in lives with very little freedom to realize ideas like that, so it would almost be disrespectful to them if I didn't do it. I could not think of a single reason not to. With a financially cautious lifestyle, I had already saved up a fair amount of money, and trying to set a vague budget for the project, I realized that I just needed to save up a bit more to be able to finance everything. There would be little money for paying for accommodation, so I would have to rely on the hospitality of people in the jiu-jitsu community instead. I had been sleeping on jiu-jitsu people's couches on all my prior travels anyway, so it was the obvious solution to do that again, just on a grander scale. My already strong network within the sport would have to be expanded to allow me to go even more places. A blog would be my tool for that. Two of my Canadian friends, a couple I had visited and trained with back in 2005, had sold everything and started living on a boat instead. I admired their adventurous spirit, and with my own idea taking shape, their home on the water was an obvious destination for me on my route. I wrote them an email and pitched the idea. They were on the way down towards the Caribbean from Canada, and with my rough idea of my schedule, it looked like I could just catch them somewhere around the Virgin Islands. With nothing else to do on the boat that day, waiting for a storm to pass, we spent several hours chatting about ideas for names for my blog. With English being my second language, my vocabulary is a bit limited, and Mike helped me coin the right one, BJJ Globetrotter. It sounded good when I said it out loud. Having worked as a programmer, I had built so many websites in my life that they became the foundation of every project and idea I started. In my world, if there was a website for something, then it was real. Everything before that only existed in my mind. It had to be written down and put online. I spent most of the night setting up the blog. The sooner I would have it ready, the sooner other people could hear about the project and invite me to come visit them on the way. "We'll teach BJJ for food and shelter," I wrote on a photo of a cardboard, put it in the header, and imagined myself standing at the side of the road somewhere in the middle of nowhere holding a sign like that. I started to realize that if everything fell into place financially and my plan succeeded, I would be able to travel anywhere I wanted, literally anywhere in the world. As long as someone there would invite me to come stay with them, there were no limits to my list of destinations. Initially, I had thought of a classic round-the-world itinerary, with cities like London, Bangkok, Tokyo, Los Angeles, New York, and Rio de Janeiro. I already knew people there, could stay a month each place, and it would be the fastest and easiest way around the globe, both travel and training-wise. That idea quickly sounded trivial as I realized the actual potential of my project. There were basically no limits for it. I could go wherever I wanted, so nothing else made sense than to put everything into making the craziest itinerary I possibly could. I had plenty of time to plan the most extreme, amazing jiu-jitsu trip I could come up with, to figure out just how far the sport could actually take me. My blog had started to take shape, and I was sending out the link to every jiu-jitsu forum I could find. I got lots of emails back, mostly from the United States. I knew that place would be easy traveling, but I was more interested in finding training in some seriously faraway places. A few companies heard about my idea as well and offered to sponsor my clothes and training gear for the trip. One guy even suggested that I should write a book about my experiences, but I quickly turned down that idea as being too crazy. While my girlfriend was still traveling around Asia and Australia on her own, I was sitting every night in front of my computer setting little pins on the map. I was looking for jiu-jitsu in places I had never heard about before. Could I travel around Africa by foot? What is the most remote island in the world where someone is training? Could I wrestle with the Mongolians in the mountains, or maybe train Sambo somewhere deep inside Russia? Was anyone training in the Arctic? I couldn't allow myself to do it the easy way. It would be the trip of my life, and maybe even the only one I could ever do, so I'd better get the best out of it. My mind was consumed with the thoughts about planning my project. As the months passed, I added more and more potential destinations to my list. It started to look ambitious. My initial idea of staying a month each place quickly went out the window. I would have to cut that down to just a few days if I wanted to make it to all the places I'd written down. Saving up money for the trip became almost a sport for me. When I got home from visiting my girlfriend in Fiji, the only thing on my mind was to prepare for my own adventure. I wasn't earning a lot of money from the gym, so I knew it would take a serious effort to save up enough to make my travel dream come true. When I shopped for food, I tried always to find cheaper alternatives to what I was looking to buy. If I saved 5 kroners on apples, I would go right home and transfer those to my savings account. If someone asked me if I wanted to go out on the weekend and I decided not to go, I took the money I would have expected to use that night and put it aside. In Denmark, we have coins equivalent to around $4, and everything above that is bills. When I had to pay for something, I always paid in cash and only in bills. All the coins I got back in change, I put in my little piggy bank so I made sure I wouldn't use them on anything else. I knew that my heating and electricity bills would be a big expense coming in January right before I was taking off. Cutting those down to a minimum became one of my dearest projects. Living on the top floor of my apartment building with a badly insulated roof, keeping the place warm in the cold Scandinavian winter was a bit difficult. I made sure to wear extra clothes indoors during the day, and at night I turned off the heaters and slept with 2 or 3 duvets to keep me warm. I got my hands on an electricity meter and measured every device in the house. I calculated that buying a new energy-efficient fridge I had seen on sale would save me money in the long run, and all my light bulbs were changed into low-energy ones. Every time I left the apartment, I turned everything off, and for a full year leading up to the trip, no device was ever in standby mode when not used. Needless to say, when the electricity and heating bill came, it was an all-time record low. The money I had saved there was more than enough to buy 2 or 3 extra plane tickets. All the small amounts I had transferred to my savings account over the year had added up, and together with the coins in the piggy bank, I had managed to collect a fair bit. The sport of saving and making every little coin count was extremely satisfying to me. Knowing that each crown I was saving while being home would be worth tenfold while on the road kept me going. I didn't need to spend that money at home, but I needed it for the trip. The next challenge would be to make the money I had last as long as possible. I was wondering a lot about what an ambitious trip like this would look like in reality. From sharing the link to the blog around the internet, I had already more than 100 invitations in my inbox, even before I'd left home. Which one should I pick? What should the route be? Would I have to plan the whole itinerary from home, or should I figure it out along the way? My mind was set on Brazil and going around the world. I would have to either begin or end my trip there. With the tough training I expected to run into in the birthplace of jiu-jitsu, I concluded that it would probably be best to pick up some skills first before I got there. The direction was set. I would be heading east. In between getting vaccinations, finding the right backpack, planning what to bring, and more importantly, what not to bring, I tried to settle my mind on a route. I would buy as many tickets from home as possible. When they ran out, I would hopefully have upped my travel skills to a level where I could easily make out the rest of the schedule on the road. I emailed back and forth with people, and it felt like every time I settled on something, I got a new interesting invitation from another place that screwed up my route and I had to rethink everything. I was juggling everything in my head, trying to solve the great puzzle. At one point, I almost gave up and thought I'd just buy the first ticket and wing it from there. On the other hand, there was a lot of money to save by buying tickets ahead of time, and saving money was going to be a very important thing for me if I was not to run out of it halfway around the globe. As I was only a few months away from my set departure date, I had the first part of a very, very ambitious schedule planned out. Starting in Paris, I was going down to Montpellier in southern France, then on to Romania, a few places in Moldova, Turkey, northern Cyprus, back to Turkey, on to India, then Borneo, Singapore, Bali, and the Philippines. I ditched the sambo training in Russia after some guy told me that there was pretty much 100% chance of getting dumped on my neck and injured if I wasn't very comfortable with falling techniques. I definitely wasn't, and with an eastbound trip, I couldn't afford a high risk of injury so early on the route. After the Philippines, I would have to figure out the rest along the way, counting on the right connections to be made through the blog and people I would meet. With all the destinations in the first part of my journey already set, I was going to give myself a serious kick in the ass, get out the door, and up into travel gear. The music filled the room of our newly built CrossFit gym. We were near the end of the road for my little competition team that season, the European Championships. It was a motley crowd of guys, made up of talent from Denmark, Iceland, Belarus, and Estonia that had all signed up for the project 6 months earlier. We had been training together almost daily since going to competitions in Sweden, the Netherlands, England, and of course Denmark. It was all part of the preparations for the big one in Portugal, where our goal was to get the first medal for our small gym. The song Not an Addict by Case Choice was playing on the stereo. I definitely was. My drug was training and had been so since I was a kid. An endless amount of hours spent in gyms since my childhood had shaped me into the person I had become. Training had been a lifelong friend, a sanctuary, a temple where I could relieve myself from the thoughts and stress that otherwise would build up in my head. My legs and lower back hurt. It was our bi-weekly workout for the team. Every Monday and Wednesday evening, we would push each other through a grinding workout, conditioning our bodies for the challenges on the mats of Europe that we faced together. It was our fourth month of preparations, and we were almost at the end. I was worried about the herniated disc in my back that I'd gotten 5 years earlier, but worked through the pain. Casper's face was twisting in exhaustion as he was pulling a thick rope across the floor with a 60-kilogram kettlebell tied to the end. I was ignoring my own logical sense telling me that I couldn't possibly do more box jumps. The projector in the ceiling behind me cast my shadow onto the wrestling video that was playing on the wall in front of me. My shadow wasn't sweating, breathing heavily, or grinding its face. It was just getting the job done, no complaints. The sweat was pouring down my face, my mind was empty, I was completely in the zone. Martin and Eric were rhythmically beating the tractor tire with heavy sledgehammers, while Jan was sprinting up and down the stairs right outside the door. Everyone around me was pushed to their individual limit, but we were in it together. We were going to get that medal at the Europeans. I wasn't particularly nervous when I stepped on the mat in the Lisbon Sports Hall. Three of our guys had already taken medals, winning one in each color for the team. My mission as a coach was accomplished, and I felt no pressure on my shoulders to win. I was still an inexperienced competitor in the brown belt division and didn't have any big expectations for my own performance. In fact, there was nothing inside me that believed I could reach the podium. The opponent was from Spain and was considerably bigger than me. He looked intimidating. I was sure he had trained and competed way more and way harder than myself. My teammates were biting their nails as I stepped onto the mat. My heart was beating a bit faster than usual, but as we clapped hands, I was calm and pulled guard right away. He had a heavy pressure game, constantly working to pass my guard. It almost succeeded a few times until I caught him with a bicep sweep and got on top. My training partner Kari shouted to me that I was ahead by 2 points. Throughout the years, I had developed an ear for picking out his voice in even the loudest of crowds. Then I made a mistake. As I stood up to open my opponent's closed guard, he jumped off and immediately took me down with a double leg. Constantly fighting his grips from there, my energy started to run out, and eventually he passed my guard, beating me 5-2. It was my debut on the big competition scene, and I was pleased with my performance. There were lots of different things to improve, and I would have plenty of different people to do that with on the road. Everyone else on the team performed fantastically, and I was really proud of the guys. I had brought blue belts with embroidered names for all the white belts and gave it to them in the hostel that same evening. They had worked extremely hard for them and deserved it more than anyone. Even more importantly, they had become really good friends of mine, and I had witnessed firsthand how jiu-jitsu had affected their lives in a positive direction over the period since they first stepped into the gym. I was going to miss them all, and honestly, I was really nervous that they wouldn't be there when I got back. In the time leading up to my departure, I fell into a very focused rhythm. I worked hard in the gym every day, preparing both my physique and jiu-jitsu for the challenges I would meet around the world. The timer beeped as the very last round ended on another long Monday night of training. I had just finished off 5 minutes against one of our seasoned blue belts, who was always a big challenge for me to handle. Training was over, I was soaked in sweat and felt great. I had been standing up in his guard as we finished. I sat down in a completely normal position when my leg rotated a little bit and then it hit me. I felt like someone had stabbed my knee with a knife. A sharp pain ran through my body and I screamed. Someone came running with an ice pack that I put on immediately. The pain was horrible and it felt like something was seriously wrong. It was just 2 weeks before I was leaving, and a serious knee injury was the last thing I needed. I was as worried as I had ever been before, and right away imagined that I would have to travel all the way around the world without being able to train jiu-jitsu. I immediately sent a text message to my physiotherapist. The next morning I was lying on the bench receiving the verdict, a small tear in the meniscus. There was no time for surgery, so all I could do was to rest as much as possible before the trip and then hope for the best. She assessed that I could train lightly, but if I felt any pain, I would need to take a few days to a week off to make sure it wouldn't get any worse. Needless to say, I was devastated. I hated the thought of having to excuse and explain myself in every sparring round I was going to do on the trip. I wanted to go out there and be able to train at whatever level and intensity people wanted to go with me. My hard preparations for rolling around the world had taken a hit, but at that point I was more worried about being able to train at all. 2 weeks without training meant 2 weeks without the opportunity to release the stress building up in my head. Everyone was constantly asking about the trip, and my mind was overloaded with thoughts and worries about how it would go. I got to a point where I just got sick and tired of thinking about it. I wasn't really looking forward to leaving. It was like I had already been through it all in my head a million times during the last year of preparations. It was frustrating to be on hold with my life, and I just wanted to board that first plane and get going. It was early in the morning when I got up, the day of my departure. The night before, I'd spread out all the stuff I had planned to put in my backpack on the floor. I was afraid that I'd missed out on something and went through the packing list again and again. 3 pairs of shorts, 1 pair of pants, 5 pairs of socks, 7 pairs of underwear, 2 geese, 1 belt, 3 t-shirts, 1 sweatshirt, small camera, big camera, cables, chargers, iPad, toiletry bag, money, passport. It was all there. The shiny new backpack was strapped up and ready to go on its maiden voyage. I was going to see the world. My girlfriend followed me to the airport with mixed emotions. On the metro train, she kissed my chin, looked me in the eyes, and smiled with a small tear in her eye. At the security check, she wasn't allowed to go any further. One last goodbye, and I was on my own with a very heavy lump in my throat. I had second thoughts about the whole thing. Was it the right thing to do? There was no turning back. Everything was planned, and I had to go through with it. It was only going to be a short flight down to Paris. The seat in front of me was taken out to make room for the emergency exit door, so I had lots of space for my long legs. I bragged a little bit about my bonus seat to the guy sitting next to me with his standard leg space, also known as no leg space. He was wearing a pinstripe suit and looked very corporate. Judging from his appearance, I guess he was probably going on a one-day business trip to Paris. The plane accelerated on the runway and the wheels released a heavy grip on the asphalt beneath us. The lump in my throat was back. I was not going to be back in my home country for a long time. Looking out the window down on the city of Copenhagen, it looked so small and flat. Nothing but a small collection of buildings, arbitrarily placed by the water on what could essentially be any flat island. There was a bit of snow left on the ground from the long cold winter. I hadn't been to the beach since summer. The water was frozen and the sand looked white and hard. When I had been down in that city, it felt like it was my entire world. Friends, family, past and future were all compressed into that small place, together with enough opportunities to live a full life from birth and death. From above, it seemed so insignificant. Why would I want to spend my entire life on that little piece of land? I could have been born anywhere in the world, so why should this exact place be the right and only life for me to live? How many other lives exist out there in the world that I could live either by chance or conscious decision? As the plane ascended, we started to hit the thick winter clouds. The view of my home city, my world, symbolically faded to white, and within seconds, it had completely disappeared before my eyes. Shortly after, we appeared above the clouds. The sky was blue, and the sun hit me in the eyes as the plane made a sharp turn to the right. It was a new beginning. I pulled my hood over my head and tried to block the sunlight while still looking out at the clouds that looked like an endless field covered in snow. I gave up and just allowed the sun to hit my face. It felt warm. I was sad to leave everything and everyone behind, but still cracked a little smile. I was reliving a life dream after almost a year of preparation. The stewardess came by and asked if I wanted to buy some food. I politely declined with a smile. I wanted to tell her that I was backpacking around the world on a budget. I couldn't afford her expensive food, but I kept that to myself. The corporate guy next to me was buying breakfast with his golden credit card. I had brought a few sandwiches from home that I had made late at night in our little kitchen. He was drinking coffee and juice. The smell of the coffee was nice. I had brought a bottle from home and filled it with water in the airport bathroom. It tasted a bit like the apple juice that had once been in it. He was falling asleep. I wished I could do the same, but there was too much going on in my head. I pulled down the window cover so he didn't get the sun in his face, plugged in my earphones, and pulled the hood over my head. I was on my way.